So, so the topic for today is password, which might seem simple, but we will discuss. So, Niloufar, has someone agreed to take notes for today? No one. Someone who hasn't before. Let's get rid of that. Skip. I should just disable it for this account. No one? It's a good way to get participation marks. If no one else will, I'll let repeats, okay. Go ahead. So, what we're going to talk about today, unless there are any big questions, is password as a program. I figured this is a simple example which illustrates a lot, not everything we want to talk about this term, but a surprisingly large number of things. So, password, as you read from the man page, is the program at the Unix command line to change your password. So you might guess that password is potentially a bit of a, you know, changing someone's password, potentially sensitive. So what's the classic implementation of password has a number of potential security issues. So what's the big one?
Forgetting your password?
No.
It'd not be like you could change the password for root.
Change the password for root. Yes. And even more.
You can change other people's passwords if you're a root?
Yes. But it's worse.
How the password is stored?
Yes, that's part of it, but worse.
Logging the plain text password?
No. So this is part of what you have to get to the mind of when you think of system security, is there is a binary on your system which can change any user's password. What access must that program have? So this requires digging a couple of levels. So first of all, where are the passwords stored? So in two files. It used to be just in /etc/password.
Yeah.
But then it got split out because etc password is readable by everyone because it has a lot of information about different users like their shell and, you know, their name. So you get MapUID name. So it's a generally useful file. But what I'm more concerned about is this.
Yeah.
Who owns the file? Who has write access to the file?
Root.
So when you run that password binary, if it's going to change that file in etc shadow, which has the same permissions except it's not readable by everyone else, I'll just show you that. So it's readable by the shadow group, not readable by anyone else, but otherwise it's still owned by root. So if you want to modify this, you need root privileges in the classic Unix model. So that should just say, okay, however it's implemented, password is going to be able to modify files owned by root. And the way the access control model of Unix works is, okay, it's not that, you can modify files owned by root and it's just these particular files. No, if you have the ability to modify files owned by root, you have the ability to modify files owned by root, full stop. And whatever privilege is associated with that. If you have the ability to modify files that are owned by root, you have the ability to modify any file on the system, at least in a local installation. Yes?
Unless, of course, your file system has gone screwy.
Your file system is what?
If your file system has gone wonky.
Wow. I mean, you know, we're talking correct operation, but, you know, when you talk about, you know, erroneous operation, all bets are off. So that's a lot of power to the password binary, when it runs, has the ability to modify any file in the system. That's why I was saying you have to think beyond, oh, you might change someone else's password. Why not just read the files you want directly? Why do you have to modify anything if you could take over that binary? So the first article is, okay, password runs, it password must run with the ability to do things as root, because that's the ownership of the files it has to modify. So either directly or indirectly it's doing that. So next question is, how does password get that level of privilege? You know the mechanism?
It has the set UID bit.
Exactly, it's a set UID bit set. So specifically, I think it's user bin. Yes. So you'll notice when I helpfully do an ls of it, it highlights it in red. That red means danger, because it's dangerous. And it's dangerous because it has this nice little sbit set. So there's only room for three bits for each, for user, group, other. So how many of you are not familiar with Unix permissions? I'm kind of assuming a little bit here. If you're feeling kind of like, should I go through it?
Yeah.
Okay. So in Unix, there are users and there are groups. In the password, when you log in, and every process has a user, actually specifically a user ID, and a group ID. And that user ID and group ID are mapped to users and groups by looking at etc password and etc group. So if you look at those, there's a name and a number. I can show you that in a second. Every file has associated with it a user and group. In this case, the user is root, and the group is root. For shadow, the user was root, the group was shadow. The permission bits associated with each file there's a few more than this, but the main ones are, you have three sets of bits, which is the way read, write, and execute, for three groups. For the user, for the group, and for other, for everyone else. So what this permission bits here says is that the owner can read and write but not execute the file. The group can read but not write or execute. And everyone else can do nothing. They can't read, write, or execute. But that's the only kind of things you only can do, the main ones. Now for user bin password, it says RWS. So there's a fourth bit, there's another extra bit in there, which is the set UID bit. And this is correspondingly a set GID bit. And that would be S if you had it in the group position instead of the user position. So the X turns to an S. You might say, well, what if the set UID bit is set and execute bit is not set? Well, it shows this as a capital S. And basically that's just bizarre because it doesn't make sense. The set UID bit only makes sense in the context of execution. So when you run this binary, normally if it just had an X here, this would just be every binary like ls. We should. So ls has the classic executable binary permissions. It's read and writable by root, readable by everyone else, and executable by everyone else. So that means everyone else, so the group, people in the same group, and everyone else in the system can read and execute this binary. So what's happened in the case of this is we've gotten this as executable and the set UID bit is set, which means that when you execute this binary, so specifically when you do the exec VE call, so in Unix, processes are created by first you create a new process by fork, and then you do an exec VE. I'm kind of assuming basic Unix knowledge. I can go over things before because OS is a prereq for this class, isn't it? But anyway, so when you do, in Unix, when you create a new process, you first do a fork creates a new process, exec VE loads a new binary. When you normally do an exece, it just loads the binary into the existing process, replacing it. But the user and group associated with the process does not change. So it's what, and it's normally whoever ran it. So if user Soma with UID 1000 doesn't exec, you know, I have a process, my bash shell, it doesn't exece of ls. LS, will, the process that now has LS, will have a user ID of 1000, just the same as before. With the set UID bit, however, that all changes. User ID of the new process, not the new process, the existing process that's getting loaded in the binary gets changed. The kernel says, you now get the user ID of you get the user ID of the owner of the file. So when you invoke password, the process that does the execve of password will now all of a sudden run as root. Now, actually what happens is the UID does not change, the effective UID changes. So this kernel still knows that, okay, this process is owned by Soma, but it is running with the privileges of root. And if your effective user ID is root, you can do anything that root can do. You are root, for all intents and purposes. Which means you can modify all resources on the system that are owned by root. And in fact, root, the kernel speech specially, it lets you also change everyone else's too. So, that's bad. That's a lot of power. So, before going into how things work, what would you want to have? Can you think of a way that you could do this, set up some sort of permissions or access or something so that maybe password wouldn't be quite so dangerous? So I wouldn't have to run with full root privilege. What sort of thing could you set up? Because you wanted to change a file that, you know, is very privileged.
Only that open up that file?
Hmm?
Like make it so that it can only open up specific files.
Right. So if you could somehow say, okay, you can, so instead of just saying you run as this user, you give it more, okay, this process can modify this file with these, you know, you have these privileges, those privileges are limited to this kind of area, like this directory or this specific file. That's all you can change. So there are, and we will talk about mechanisms, classic things like SE Linux, you've heard of it, is precisely the kind of system which allows you to limit the actions of programs like password. Say, okay, yeah, password's running as root, but it's only going to be able to modify etc password. It can't modify anything else. But that's not the classic Unix model. And as we'll talk about, that model where you start having those sort of restrictions runs into problems. Specifically, well, if you limited things, what if you have to change how that program behaves? Who has the rights to do that? Because if you were trying to limit it, and now you lost someone to change those, then both of you get any benefit in security, you know. So tricky. Any other kind of things to limit the potential damage? Because just think, if you made any mistake, if you've made any mistake in coding password, now you might think password's actually a simple program. It's not. So what's great is to understand the complexity of a program, look at its options. And there's a number of options, and some of them are a little complicated. Apply them in a different directory, near your root directory, change password in repository, lock the password. Okay, that's still modifying it. But inactive, expire, delete. I think those are the main dangerous ones. Yeah, the
root. So, yeah.
It's not quite so simple. It's not hard-coded to always modify that file. You basically can specify a base directory and it will change etc password in any subdirectory. Can you think of a way to make that an attack?
Your creature own etc password?
So you change etc password, but then what's the big... I mean, that's what it's exactly designed for. So you can use password to modify regular files. But what could you do with that regular file? Any other Unix?
I don't know, maybe like SSH to a server.
No, I'm thinking much simpler.
Could a ransom? Could you write a file that when you run it would change your own privileges?
No. I'm thinking about using the exact functionality we said. It's like, okay, I can modify etc password, but I can specify the base directory. That's what this.
So let me explain. So the option I'm talking about here is root. Applying changes in the chroot dir directory to use a configuration file from the chroot dir directory. So what this means is treat another directory as if it was the top level directory. So instead of changing etc password, it would change home soma etc password. Home soma testdev etc password. So this is, before there were containers, there were chrooted environments. Which basically means change the root, as in the top of it, not the user root. So this is saying I can change etc password as a as a file in an etc directory in any base directory. So that means that the user can control the contents of the password file, which is useful if you're setting up a little environment. But what can I do more with that?
If you do that and you actually create a password, for example, for a user, then you can actually use that hash if you eventually do manage to get write access to password. If you can just replace the hash yourself later to a known value.
No, I'm saying you're changing it in a user's directory.
Yes.
So you can control the file.
Yeah.
So you change it there.
Yeah.
How does that affect the whole system?
It doesn't yet.
Right, but yeah, well, the hashes, I guess if you have someone run it, that means you have to fool someone into running it this way, the different options. So if someone's fooled you into running it, that's kind of a different level problem.
Since you have control over the file that it's writing to, you can symlink it to any other file?
There you go. That's what it is. You make etc password a symlink to any other file you want, and all of a sudden you're making a password file like change to another random file in the system. Maybe what you could even do is you create your own password file and you do all this thing and it thinks that you're allowed to do this because, it's all fine, but that's actually a symlink to the real password file. So it lets you change any entry in this unprivileged file because because it's yours. That's kind of the mode you'd want. It's like it should be able to change anything. You can't look at the real user permissions. But now you symlinked it to the real one, now you're changing the password in the system password file. So what I'm pointing out is that in the name, flexibility is in general the enemy of security. Because flexibility means more functionality means more corner cases that you didn't think through all the security implications of what you did. If you go back in the old, the annals of, security, CVEs, I'm not sure if these even would have CVEs. They probably have historic ones. But there are definitely examples of implementations of the password program, which had vulnerabilities, which allowed you to basically take over the password binary. And then you would basically have full root privilege to do whatever you want. Because now I'm just talking about using the command line options. What if there's using fixed size buffers? Like, what if the username expects it to only take up 100 characters? Because who would have a username of more than 100 characters, right? And then you give it 1,000 characters. Now you've overwritten the entire stack. It didn't check because it just read it in using sprintf or something, and whatever, or scanf or something. And now you've overwritten all the memory, and now you've taken over the program. I mean, we'll talk about all the ways in which you can compromise a binary as we go through the class, but I'll just say now, there's lots of ways to do it. So running programs with full privileges is inherently dangerous. There are ways to limit the privileges, but it is hard to make systems that allow you to limit the privileges that are also usable.
So the vulnerabilities, are they more caused by bad decisions or by bad code?
What's the
like code could be maybe like some bugs or just some checks haven't been made.
So is it a design problem or is it an implementation problem
yeah.
kind of thing? I guess. I mean it varies. I mean that's the nature of security vulnerability that you have to appreciate. It's you name the kind of mistake, it's been done. And has it been able to be used to get some sort of exploit? Yes, it has. Attackers are very creative. As they have to be. That's how they get around things. And they have a very deep understanding of how things work. Which is why in order for you to master the subject, you have to think more than just about security. You have to think, well, in the context in which I'm looking, I have to understand how things work. That's why I can't just say, oh, you've got a password file. Come on over here. You can't think in the sort of loose way that, oh, it can change a password file. Why can't it change the password file? Why can't anyone else change the password file? What are the barriers that allow one to do it and the other one not to do it? What's the mechanism? And the fact is the mechanisms are, in traditional systems, are actually pretty simple. They're not complicated. That's part of the reason why they persist is because they can be understood by regular people. And they are flexible enough to allow you to set reasonable policies which will restrict things yet without tying your hand behind your back so you can't actually change things or figure out what's happening. Windows has a much more sophisticated permission model than standard Linux and standard Unix systems. And it's almost never used. The Unix permission model is used very effectively. If you look at a Linux system, a lot of protection is gotten by the very simplistic system that's there because it's still easy to understand. So, throwing it away and saying it's adding in a much more complicated system, they do exist for Linux, but actually those aren't used mostly either. Because in fact, no one understands how to use them. So let's step back then. So we're going to have this binary. It's going to run with root privileges. It's going to have the power to change anything on the system. I'm writing the program. How do I make sure my binary is not going to be compromised? It's basically, it's like you've been given this very powerful tool. It's like, here, the blowtorch. How do you make sure you don't burn off your arm or anyone else's, or set the building on fire? You've got to have measures to protect yourself. So what measures do you think a development... One thing is just code your program correctly. Don't make any mistakes. Sure. Yes, and if pigs had wings, they would fly. Not going to happen. So, you know you're going to make mistakes. How do you limit the scope of your mistakes?
Is there software to analyze your code to prevent sort of simple things like overflow?
That's called getting rid of the bugs.
Okay.
It's good to get rid of bugs.
Yeah.
You're not going to get rid of all the bugs.
True.
So that's actually what we want to think about. How do we protect ourselves from ourselves? I mean, it's like you've got a really sharp knife in your hand. How do you make sure you don't stab yourself with it? And there's certain ways you hold the knife. There's certain things you choose to do. That's what you're doing. That's what you're facing.
What about like sandboxing?
So sandboxing. So these are all things to... So sandboxing is a good thing to put around the app. that's what you do. Is like you didn't write it, and you go like, I don't trust what the developer did, so I better, you know, put something around it. Sandboxing is good where you can use it, and we will certainly be talking about that this term. But how about when you write the sandbox? You know, I mean, I'm saying it's always, you get to the point where you've got to make sure you don't mess things up. So what would you like to be able to do? Think of it this way. Someone gives you a key to a safe that has some item that you need for the company. You know, let's say you're working for a large, you know, organization. There's, you know, some document you need to get from the safe. But also in the safe is $100 million worth of things. Basically, it's very small documents that you could very easily pick up and move or things, and you'd have $100 million if someone else could. Very valuable contents in the safe. You don't want to be responsible for things being stolen from the safe.
Make sure it's audited?
No. Again, that's finding the bugs. Okay. Saying, if I have been given the key to the safe, what precautions am I going to take?
Don't get caught when you take the 100 mil.
Put the safes inside safes.
No. Think very simply. You're given a key to a safe with ridiculously valuable things. You have to go in there and get something and get it out.
You need to plan everything ahead of time.
Plan ahead of time. Yes, simple.
Just make sure you're like no one's following you when you're taking out something.
Do you take the key home?
No.
Do you just keep it in your back pocket? Do you walk around all day with the key? No.
Have a master key?
As I've said, sometimes you have a master key.
Yeah.
So.
Can a safe?
Yeah, I would say you make sure the key had to be kept somewhere safe most of the time, right? So when you get the key, you check it out and say, okay, I'm going to the safe right now. I will be back in 2 minutes, okay? And I'm going to have a buddy with me while I go, maybe an armed buddy. You say, we're going to go to the safe, we're going to go in, we're going to take it out. And they give the key back and say, oh, it's not mine anymore. Yep. And see, I had someone with me, and see, I didn't do anything bad, and see, I gave it back. So, you know, if I could have done anything bad, it would have had to been these 2 minutes, and, you know, there was someone watching me the whole time. I mean, two separate things here. One is, you limit the time in which you have the dangerous privileges. And you ideally minimize the privileges that you have. And then, ideally, you have some way of auditing, of verifying that the permissions were used in an appropriate way. Basic principles. If you have to do something dangerous, minimize the time of weakness. If you have to use a blowtorch, don't just keep the blowtorch running on the stand while you're doing everything else. You turn it off. Because a blowtorch that's off is much less dangerous than a blowtorch that is on. Simple things. And similarly with programming, if you have a program that requires lots of privileges, minimize the time in which it has those privileges.
So, just knowing basic Unix mechanisms, it turns out there's some fancier ones in modern systems, but just knowing basic mechanisms, what could you do?
Have password, for example, run as a normal user and then have a separate one that is set to 1-bit, perhaps?
So what you could do is you can split the binary so that you have one part of it that's privileged, and one part of it's not. That is one way of doing it. Another way is just to split up your program inside of it. So the idea is you do all the privileged operations in one separate bit, and then do all your try to do everything else after you've done that. So the classic thing is, can I open the password file without analyzing all the input I've been given by the user? analyzing input from the user and trying to process it is the most dangerous operation you face, because that input is untrusted, and that input might cause you to lose your mind. You all know about the very dangerous Pokemon cartoon, right? Mm-hmm. You guys talk? So there was this Pokemon cartoon that was aired, you know, many years ago, that sent like hundreds of kids to the hospital.
Oh, yeah.
Because it had flashing, you know, images as strobing things. I think it's in like cyberspace or Africa. But it's like floating thing. And so it induced seizures in children. And so to this day, you'll look at a lot of things. It's like they say, this could induce seizures because we have some things where they might be flashing, you know, rapid patterns on the screen and certain things. And, you know, we are subject to, you know, malicious input attacks. Not to say, you know, people who have been taken over by cults or whatever. I mean, you know, input is dangerous. It's dangerous to us. It's dangerous to programs. That's how you're typically going to compromise a program, is by giving it bad input. So the classic engineering thing you do in your program is when you separate where you process regular user input from where you actually do the privileged operations. And you minimize the intermingling of the two and you separate that out. So what I'm thinking will be an interesting exercise for you all is to try to create your own version of password. I mean, as a program, it's really simple. It's not a complicated program, especially if you decide, well, if you write it in C, you've got to deal with a lot of things with, you know, parsing strings, and doing anything with strings in C is painful, but you don't have to write it in C. You can write it in Python or JavaScript or whatever you felt like. You know, there's really no reason not to. But can you make it set UID root? And can you actually make it do something? Now, if you're developing your own, don't have it modify the real password file on your system. Try having it modify another one. Or you can code it. If you really want to work on Windows, you can code another program there. And then, but you should probably plan on doing some Linux hacking. So I'm going to be setting up some VMs and do things. And I think one thing we might try doing is actually developing one. I'm going to try, I think, building one in JavaScript, but I don't necessarily want to do that in class right now. I'm going to write one offline and then can show you what I built. And then we can talk through what mistakes I made in the code. So now I'm going to come on. There we go. I don't know what that was. So I touched on a lot of things just in talking about the password programs. And remember, this is about the simplest real security problem I could think of. So the system security problem is that real program. And it touched a lot of things. What are the concepts that I have talked about? So access control, yeah.
Would privilege be part of access control or separate?
I kind of put it separate, even though it certainly overlaps. So access control is kind of the rules of who can do what, but privilege is really about access controls, who has access to the blowtorch. Privilege is kind of more what can burn.
Right.
So, and specifically what I've talked about is, I've talked about privilege and the idea that you can do damage. And so the normal way you handle having a problem with privileges is you try to enforce least privilege. Now this is, what is least? What's as little as possible? I mean, that's depends on the mechanisms that you're given and the context and stuff, and oftentimes it's not practical to go with the least. But less is better than more. If you do it with less privilege, you're better off with more privilege. So, from a design perspective, what's wrong with the password mechanism for Unix in terms of least privilege?
It doesn't seem to have least privilege.
It doesn't have to be least privilege, but what's the real nasty part? What leads to all this messiness?
Has most privilege?
Well, it's most privilege, but what about it? It's the way that it's framed.
Yes, that you're ready.
Well, that's the mechanism. Say, what's the task? And the task is there's a file that everyone's passwords are in. And so who can change the file that everyone's passwords are in, information about all the accounts on the system? Clearly, that not everyone can change that. That has to be limited. And so what you instead have is a file with maximum restrictions, thus you may need maximum access to modify it for any individual user. What's a simple way you could change this so that wasn't the case?
And you can give each user their own password file?
Exactly. Why does it have to be one file? Why can't we have one file per user?
Because home directories are weird.
What?
Home directories are weird.
So it doesn't have to be in the home directory.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be in the home directory. You could have a directory, etc, password, and then slash, and then it would be the username. And that file would be owned by me. It might be owned by me, or it might be in my group or something. And you could make it, you know, real. But the idea is that it's restricted. There's a couple ways to do it, but it's restricted to me. And actually, well, you might as well just make it so it's readable. Like, you might have two files. One is my public information, one is my private information. My private information would have, you know, soma-public. Or actually make this even a directory. Makes that a directory and have a public file and a private file inside of that. And the public file is readable by everyone, but writable by me, and the private file is only readable by, you know, by me, and maybe by the group. And maybe you run a little utility that might change the permission so that this file is also readable by the program that lets you in, the login program. So you could change the architecture just to make it least privilege. But have it. You could say on older systems you might not have wanted to do that because this would generate right now with one file, it doesn't require that many bytes to store it. If you did this, I mean, you could take, I mean, just the overhead of having that many files is probably many times more than the actual storage. On modern systems, who cares? We tell them, okay, it might take 16K to store information on one account.
No.
who cares? But remember when these systems were first developed, you know, 16K might be an appreciable fraction of your working memory, or even of your disk space. I mean, your disk space might be measured in a couple of megabytes. So wasting 16K per user could have been a really bad idea. But, so this was certainly space efficient.
They've got plenty of things though that have made things less efficient, so why wouldn't they change
Why do you think?
It's awkward for making large changes.
Well, awkward. Well,
all applications depend on the legacy software, right?
Yep. Lots of programs expect to know about password file. Expect to find information in the password file. If you all of a sudden turn it into a directory or something else, they're just gonna go, ah! But of course, you could say, well, why don't we just do this for changing things and let it be this way? And then maybe we have a script that runs that generates the real password file.
Then you compromise the script.
But then you compromise the script, yeah. But at some point you have untrusted user input. But maybe you could also say regular users shouldn't actually be able to manipulate their passwords because then that's untrusted input for everyone that authenticates the system. Does any sort of authentication. So maybe that's a worse problem because you don't want them manipulating the hashes. This is often the nature of security, is when you start picking at it, you start going, well, why didn't they just do it this way? And you go, well, okay, but then you have to do this, and then you got this problem, and this, there's all these constraints that don't become obvious until you actually work through it. And I'm not saying you can't come up with things that are better. I'm saying that things are the way they are for reasons, and the reasons are typically not completely stupid. Sometimes there are, but not generally for these foundational things.
You know, I was like 5 minutes late, but didn't it used to be that ETC password was storing passwords in plain text at one point?
The oldest systems I know were always having them hashed. Right. Actually, the original Unix ones used a modified version of DES for storing as their hashing algorithm. That was not the problem. The problem was, okay, so let's talk about other attacks. So what? The original version of the password file had not only information on the user accounts, so what's your name, what's your shell, what's your home directory, what's your user ID, what's your group ID, but it also had your password hash. So what's the problem with leaving the password hash in a file that anyone on the system can read? Basically, breaking the hash. Rainbow tables is one way, but rainbow tables only kind of more modern. But if someone wants to just guess your password, they take your password hash and they just see, is it the right password? Is it the right password? Is it the right password? I mean, it's one thing if you're having to go in through a frontline system which can limit the number of login attempts. If you have a copy of the hash, you can try 10 million times or more to guess their password. Will someone come up with your password if they're willing to try 10 million times? Some of you, maybe not. Others of you, almost certainly yes. I mean, it's hard to come up with things that a computer can't just brute force. I mean, you have to make pretty long passwords. And even there, systems are actually, can be amazingly fast nowadays. I mean, you can do things to trade space for time with like such as rainbow tables. These are other things we'll talk about. But password cracking is an art form, and a surprisingly sophisticated one. But it only works if you have access to the hashed version of the password. If you don't have access to that, you can't do any of those tricks. And you just have to deal with the program that says, oh, wrong try, try again, try again in 10 seconds, try again in a minute, try again in 10 minutes. Oh, you've tried too many times, you're gonna have to wait till tomorrow before you can try again.
How do you know how it got hashed? Let's say you got access to the hash passwords, how do you know what process was used to hash it?
What algorithm was used?
Yeah.
Depends. That certainly is a way you could try modifying, but in general, we assume that the attacker can figure that out. And the way they can figure that out is actually pretty simple. If they can do that, they can probably set their own password. And then they can try all the well-known algorithms and see which of them work. All the information is there. Then you might say maybe they use the custom one that you don't know about. That's certainly possible, but those sort of secrets tend not to keep.
There's a question over here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Do you think
I realize it was wrong, but you could probably look at the source of the implementation.
Yeah, but you don't have to look at the source. You can look at the binary.
Yeah, you can look at the binary.
Run the binary or something.
Run the binary, yeah. Actually, that's true. If you can run the binary, you might be able to have it do the tries for you.
On your own system.
If you were doing your own custom hash, wouldn't you be risking doing it badly and just making it easier for people to break?
Yep, that's possible too. That this is the whole, you know, what's the one rule you should always know from cryptography? Don't make your own crypto. It's really easy to make a code that you cannot break. That doesn't mean someone else can't break it. You just think, oh, I can't figure out a way to break this. Oh, it must be secure. What you end up with if you make up your own crypto is crypto that can be broken by anyone who has a clue. You might say, well, most people don't have a clue, so you're safe. Okay, but what's your threat model? What are you trying to protect? So, going back, least privilege. What are the things?
Software itself is capable of, like the when we looked at the manual on the command.
Okay, so yeah, we talked about I would say the security relevant concept is user input. So, you know, all right, specifically on. Unsanitized input. Saying, like, you gave some weird. Now, a natural thing is, well, what is sanitized? When is the input safe? And whenever someone says you sanitize the input, that's more of a. It's a wish fulfillment exercise. It's like, I think I sanitized it. You can't be sure. I mean, because really, let's think about it. It's like, well, if I got rid of all the special characters, there's no way they could hurt me. Are you sure about that? Do you have proof of that? And then someone says, hold my beer, and then they show you how to break your thing. We saw unsanitized input. What we're talking about is input is dangerous. And user support, you know, unsanitized input. It's more general. Untrusted. If you have untrusted input, it could make, you know, you make more or do weird things. Most input to programs is untrusted. Because that's kind of the point of programs. To process data. I mean, so what you want to do then is sanitize it, which means that now, okay, yeah, it's from an untrusted source, but we've vetted it, so now we can trust it. You say the root of all evil and security, this is probably it. You say this one, because that's how you break systems.
In terms of untrusted input, I can think of an example where trusted input might be bad. In a database that doesn't check for similar names. So my dad and my brother have the same name, and they get each other's mail constantly. Fake name, you can get someone else's mail, as an example.
Right. So when I say trusted input, when you say something's trusted, all you're really saying is if it betrays you, you're screwed. That's what it means, especially in a computer security context. Although when you look outside of it, what does it mean to trust someone? It means they have the ability to hurt you. You don't trust them, you kind of like keep your distance, you don't interact with them or whatever. But if you trust them, then they can hurt you. Now, maybe your trust is limited. Like, for example, when I'm driving a car down the road, I trust that other cars on the road are not actively trying to ram into me. It's a limited form of trust. But it's a very important trust. And in fact, if I did not have that basic assumption, you can't drive anywhere because it'd be too dangerous. And the moment you see a car, and I don't know if you've ever kind of been driving, I don't know how, some of you may not know how to drive. but you can take my word for it then. If you're driving down the road, particularly late at night, and you see a car in front of you that is driving erratically, it's kind of swerving over the lanes, kind of going this way, it's quickly accelerating, then slowing down, accelerating. What do you do?
Hang back.
You avoid the car. You know, you try not to get close to it. You keep, you know, enough distance so you can move around it. You know, and if it's really bad, you might get on the phone and call someone to say, you know, there's a car with this license plate that you may want to pull over on this road because it's kind of dangerous. And then you'd quickly try to get on a different road from where that car's going. You know, when it's untrusted, you change your behavior. Similarly, programs should too when they deal with different inputs. If it's an input on a file that's actually owned by the developer of the application and so is put in there, and so really it's the same privilege as the application itself, okay, you can consider that trusted. But if it's supplied by an outside user, who knows? But maybe again, do you really trust that file that your program, you know, created? Maybe someone decided to modify it. I mean, maybe you should verify that. I mean, it's, trust is hard. Let's say another recurring theme. Here, so, axe crow, least privilege, unsanitized input. Kind of. And then, also talking about set UID. So this comes to, when we talk about things like access control and least privilege and stuff, you have to always keep in mind that who had the privilege. Whenever you're granted privilege, a program's granted privilege, it comes from somewhere else. Someone else gave it to you. Who gave it to you? So who had the power? And so, tip for most programs, you're starting with the kernel. The OS had the privilege, and they said, oh, we're going to delegate you. You now have this power. They had the blowtorch. They're giving it to you. How long do you want that blowtorch? Don't burn your fingers off. You know, basic rules of the road. Now, you might say, well, how do you keep the kernel from messing with its privileges? That's a whole separate topic.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned limiting the time in which you have access to the dangerous privileges. Does that fall under access control, least privileges?
That's more least privilege.
Least privilege?
Yeah. Access control says who has access to what?
Not how long.
Not how long. And most access control models actually don't even include time as a mechanism. Now, there's, when I say least privilege, it's time and space. It's like minimize how long you have the privileges and minimize the scope of the privileges. Can you limit yourself to a fireproof room? That's a nice thing for, if you talk about sandboxing. That's in effect what you're doing. Play in here. I think there's more stuff, but those are the main ones. What else on the Unix command line is kind of like this? Kind of like that password program. Chmod? Is chmod?
Can you change the permissions? So?
So what makes something like this password problem? What are the characteristics of something that's like this in terms of like, oh my god, we're in danger?
Anything with the set UID bit?
With the set UID bit. So we're looking for executables that run as another user, particularly running as root, or they could run as just another user that isn't being applied. Particularly the set UID root binaries. This is definitely an issue. So it's a little broader than that, but let's start with the set UID ones. What binaries do you know are set UID on Unix? Some classic ones that you may use.
I know that the fuse, if you mount, fuse mount system.
So binaries associated with mounting, typically file systems in user space. Mount is often set UID root. Things for fuse is also.
Cron tab?
Cron. Well, cron specifically.
Yeah.
Well, about cron tab, I guess, too, because, you run...
executing programs.
So this actually gets to an interesting point. Cron...
I'm just going to do a quick check here, because I don't think cron tab... I think cron tab runs as a user, but I'm not sure. Crontab does not is set GID crontab, but so you have to be in the the crontab group is what allows you to modify cron. So anyone know what cron is? So when we say crontab, it's cron table.
Isn't it a scheduler for repeating tasks?
Yeah, exactly, it's cron as in chronos, as in time.
On my system, the crontab binary is a set UID.
It is. Interesting. So, whatever the case is, so cron is normally a daemon that runs in the background. I think cron's running in the background of my system.
Because there's a couple of...
Cron is not.
So on my system, cron is running in the background.
So there is a binary running as root in the background, which is there to run time-oriented tasks. The idea is if you want something to happen at 3 a.m. every day, you tell cron, do this at 3 a.m. You can say, do it not just at 3 a.m. every day, do it at 3 a.m. on the first Monday of the month. So this is the thing for doing periodic tasks. So the most common use of cron is things like cleaning up log files. Because log files, if you let them just grow for too long, will overwhelm your system, so it will compress them and rotate them and eventually delete them as necessary. So that's a classic cron task. So cron, though, is a program that sits there and listens to the background and runs things as different users. Every user can specify their own cron task, and the cron program will proceed to go through and execute them. So if cron is not written properly, cron will start doing things as other users. Might even start running jobs as root when created by a non-root user. That would be bad. So cron certainly related things.
Also the pseudo binary, for sure.
Pseudo! That set UID in a big way. Because how does sudo do what it does? Because it's root and set UID, because it has to run with root privileges. How else is it going to run commands as root? You could say, couldn't you just have a regular program run and it talk to a background daemon that allows you to run? Yes, same difference. It doesn't really buy you anything. But again, this is a program that you run at the command line, give it arbitrary input, and if you're not careful, there's going to be security vulnerability. And in fact, sudo is supposed to provide the mechanisms for saying, okay, you could do this as root, but only this. Like, you could make a system such that you take away the set UID bit on password, and instead you add rules to sudo to say that regular users can run password as root. And so you would have, instead of typing password, you type sudo password. And then type your username if you change it. But But yeah, well, you in the standard implementation, you want to do that because that means you'd run password as root, and you could change anyone's password and not be bad. But you see, anything that changes privileges, does things that you can't do otherwise, these are the points of danger. This is how you escape the sandbox of your processes, user UID and GID. So yeah, sudo, those are ones. Other ones are kind of weird. Things like ping. Think ping.
Is that right? Yep, ping is set UID root.
So you know why ping might be set UID root? Yeah, basically it has to send, so ping sends out raw ICMP packets. And that's a privilege operation, being able to send stuff like that, so hard root access. So if you look around at programs that do various like low level things, they often are set UID root. So just on a Linux system, just go through, do an ls-la and grep for that. There's a couple of ways of doing it. I normally grep for rws and ls-la in the binary directories and see what shows up.
Interestingly, ping does not have set UID on my system.
What distribution are you running?
I'm running Arch.
Arch, okay. I'm running Ubuntu.
Yeah.
So Ubuntu is a Debian derivative, and so it comes from the Debian. I wonder why ping is. I don't know. I mean, I think on modern systems you might not need, but yeah, pings. I just checked. It's set UID root on my system. But I wonder if you do certain operations whether it's allowed or not.
It probably is allowed. But it might not be for some things which you'd have to give it group privileges.
I would have to look at exactly what functionality requires group privileges or not. So, how much time do we have? There's one last thing I'd like to talk about if I have time. Yeah, I have a couple minutes. So, I should be clear, this notion of determining what access you have based upon users and loops is pretty darn coarse. And it's coarse enough that it's hard to implement this idea of least privilege in lots of circumstances. So, what you'd really want is a way to subdivide it. I mean, think of all the powers that root has. Password may need the ability to modify a file owned by root, but does it really need the ability to mount entire new file systems? Or does it need the ability to talk to the raw devices? No, it doesn't. So wouldn't it be nice if instead of having all those privileges, could we have a subset of those privileges? And so this gets to the notion of, well, in the literature, it's got a couple of names, but this notion of capabilities. Now, I'll talk about how capabilities are in Linux systems, which is a bit different from capabilities in other systems. But in Linux, when we talk about capabilities, what it is it's a subdivision of privilege. It's saying that your root isn't just root. Root is a collection of all these different capabilities. So if you have root level access, you have access to this list of like 20 different capabilities. And so what you can do when you're running your program, if you run as root, you can drop these capabilities. Basically, you drop your privileges, not so you just don't become root, but so, okay, I give up everything except my ability to talk to raw devices. That's all I'm going to keep. Or I'm going to drop everything except my ability to modify files. And that way, if the program gets compromised, it actually limits the damage that you can do. Which is all well and good. There's just one problem. You know what the problem is? Some of these capabilities are ridiculously powerful. Like, if you have the ability to modify files, what can you do with that?
Anything.
Just about anything, eventually. I mean, it might take you a couple of steps, but if you can start modifying files, you can do all kinds of crazy stuff. If you have access to devices, what can you do? Almost anything, because why can't you modify the hard drive and get at the file system that way? It may take maybe a little more painful, but you still could potentially mess with the system. So these sort of capabilities are useful in some circumstances, but they don't cure all problems. Like, the big things I think this helps is like some programs need to bind privilege ports. So in Unix, a port number below 1024 is considered to be privileged, which means that only root can bind to those ports. So the theory is that if you connect to a service that's running on a low-numbered port on a Unix system, you know it's a real system service, as opposed to ones run on higher ports could be started by any old user. Now, of course, you go to other systems, they don't really disrespect that, or if you control your system, that distinction is not nearly as important now as it used to be. But still, on Unix, in order to bind low-numbered ports, you need root privilege. But that means I want to run a web server on port 80, or on port 443, those are privileged ports. So that means my web server needs root access, which is not what you want. You do not want your web server root access. So one way to do this is you can just give your web server the capability of, or make a wrapper binary that just starts your web server, and all it keeps is the ability to bind to low number of ports and drops everything else. That's a useful thing. And that does improve security, but yeah. As far as the bigger story or capabilities, it's a different way of looking at access control, which gets into some different concepts that I do not have time to talk about now.
What time? Okay, I have a couple minutes.
So to end up, we have a few minutes. Let's talk about other exercises that you could do. And by this weekend, I'm going to try opening up like the exercise. The idea is I'm going to have basically 8 exercises open. The due date will be roughly, every week or so, kind of spaced out, but I would highly advise you to try to get something done on a timely basis, but I'm going to leave the submissions open. And so as long as you get them done by the end of the semester, it'll be helpful. But a lot of these things may actually help you understand things for the assignment. So, the assignments are a separate thing. So it's really, really, I see experiences. They really are just to try to get your knowledge of the subject, get a bit depth to it. First, test it and see what it takes to actually make it set UID root, and then test it out on your own system and change your password. Do it on a system that's disposable.
A VM?
Yes, do it on a VM. Well, obviously not just a VM, a system that's disposable, because you might have a VM you care about. So, be careful. But can you make it set UID root? Can you get it to do all the hashing and stuff? When you really look into it, it's not that hard. I mean, if you're doing an exercise like this, you could implement your own hash, or if you wanted to, you could just try to make it that it doesn't hash and just stores it and just for practice. But get as far as you can. Depends on how good of a program. Think through all the things that you have to, try to implement all the options. that password offers. Can you do that in a secure fashion? If you're using this in a language like Python, most of the string processing and other things are trivial. Manipulating the entries, those are really, really trivial. The only things that I see as hard are how do you make sure you process the input carefully? How do you do, how do you drop privileges maybe? Look into how to do all those things. Do as an exercise, and so why am I doing this as a experience and not an assignment? Again, this is, we're going to list many of these things, and this is just what I'm kind of saying now. You have lots of other ones you can do. Why am I doing it this way rather than a full assignment? First of all, I don't want to try grading this. I mean, in terms of like all these things. Second of all, the most important thing that you're going to get out of this is not writing a complete one. It's thinking through all the issues. And what I want to see in your write-up about this, by any of your experiences, is not documentation on a program that works perfectly. I want to hear about how you messed up. I want to hear about all the wrong turns or all the challenges or all. What was your experience with this? What did you learn? What did you find out? That's what I want. No, there is. Here you are. Privileges are required for networking. Now, when I say networking, I mean that's a bit of a broad thing, but you know, there's the networking things that regular programs can do. And versus there's clearly like some things like ping sometimes need certain privileges, or certainly for changing the routing table for your system, that certainly requires root access. Regular programs can't do that. So what privileges are required to do what operations? Just trying to go through and figure out that and make a list of those. That's an interesting exploration. Now, I'm gonna talk about some of those things, probably in relation. I'm not gonna go through this in detail, not so much because it's not interesting, but it's a bit out of scope, just because we start getting into really detailed networking issues. And your first approximation, the distinction's easy. Regular programs can use the network for regular network communications, but configuring the network is a privileged operation. Which makes sense. But when you really break it down, what does that mean? It gets a little bit tricky. Things like, can a regular user connect to a new Wi-Fi access point? You know? That may require some privileges. How much privileges? Maybe certain users can use a program that does it in a certain interface, so you can change certain things, but not other things. I mean, what can you change, what can't you change? I think if you dig into it, I think each of these things I kind of see is like, it should take you a few hours to kind of at least make some good progress on it. If you have a really interesting time, some of you I might want you to share your experiences with some of these things. Oh yeah, I did an exploration of this and I figured this out. Like, I would like to know why ping is set UID here on some systems and not in other systems.
So it actually turns out that different systems can have different capabilities set for ping. So for getcat and setcat. Which will allow you to have certain capabilities of root without actually having to set UID ping.
Right. So you're saying Arch sets capabilities in the file system?
Some of them, yes. It has set for ping. It has set it to allow ROS connections to sockets.
Okay, so it's actually a privileged binary.
It's privileged, but it's not set UID.
So that's another mechanism So you know how to set UID? It turns out there's set capabilities. So it is it's basically an auto run does that. Only certain Linux file systems support it.
Probably not.
Anyway, I think we're out of time.
So we'll keep building on this list. If you think of ideas for ones you'd want to do, go ahead and mention it on Slack, and we can discuss.